Our first speaker, Ethan from Atlantic City.
Ed.
Oh, right here. Ed. What was that, Ed?
Ed.
Yeah, what's an A-O-O? Where Ed at? Oh, you go, Ed. How you doing, my friend?
I'm all right.
I'm Ed, E.D., Edward, Eddie, if you like, all of that. I'm an addict from Frederick, Maryland. I tell you what, I don't like sharing at conventions. I like more intimate groups. I like my home group, and I like groups in my area, and I like, you know, when I'm feeling the subject and all of those good things. So when the person that asked me to share at the convention asked me, I said no. And he asked me again. And I said, well, let me talk to my sponsor. And so 3 weeks passed. I didn't talk to my sponsor. And he asked me again. And so I finally talked to my sponsor. My sponsor suggested that I do it. He reminded me that the program in Narcotics Anonymous has done so much for me, that this little hour, half an hour, this little uncomfortable moment is the least I could do for this program. And so I'm here. And I hope I share a message that somebody can take with them, that they can use and carry and gain some hope and strength from. And if it's not the message that you need, that's okay. Keep coming back. There's plenty of other people with plenty of other messages that you can connect to. So all of that said, I came up with, I think, 3, 4, 7 different scenarios on step nine to share on. And I dreamt about it, and I stayed up until 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about it, and I looked at all of the basic texts and just what it, all of that. You know, I did all of the things, got way, way up in my head, you know, with no help from anybody. And I was sitting out here on the bench out here, and I was thinking about step nine, and it made me think about when I first got here. You know, those first couple of days, those first couple of weeks, that first moment when I realized that this was the place where I needed to be. And I realized that, you know, what I was feeling when I first got here was shame and guilt, just an overwhelming amount of shame and guilt. I had been asked to leave my friend's house because I had, I like to say borrow, they say stole, their car, and I had borrowed $50 out of their purse, which, you know, I did that by crawling in their room on my hands and knees to their purse and pulled out the money. I had borrowed their liquor and replaced it with water, and they weren't happy, and they asked me to leave. They said they couldn't help me. I needed to go someplace where I could get the help that was needed. And these were people that took me in and wanted the best for me. They were willing to help me. And anyhow, they dropped me off from Frederick, Maryland. I'm originally from D.C., and they dropped me off from Frederick, Maryland. And if anybody's been to Frederick, Maryland, it's grown up in the last 16 years. But if anybody's been to Frederick, Maryland, it's sort of an Andy Griffin kind of Mayberry-ish town. You know, I got there and there's like cows and people saying hello, and, you know, and for a D.C. boy, it wasn't the place to be. And I ended up in Frederick, Maryland, you know, in this homeless shelter filled with shame and guilt. And it wasn't just about that situation. It was about other situations that happened in my past, you know, all of the rest of the people that I had taken advantage of in some kind of way, some effort, some way, you know, family members that allowed me to come in and stay in their house, same scenario, that I borrowed money from. I like to say borrow. Somebody told me I was in denial. You stole, dude, you know, is what they tell me. But I took money from them, and it was like family, friends, cousins, aunts, grandmothers, you know, anybody that was close enough to feel like that they wanted to help me were like in that category of people that I could make into a victim. You know, I mean, they were, you know, the means to my getting high. I know a lot of people, you know, I hear friends talk about, you know, being able to cop weight, you know, quarter pounds and ounces, and, you know, the most weight I ever cop was an 8-ball, and that was with somebody else. You know, I was the kind of addict that, you know, the little itty-bitty bags, that's what I was smoking, you know, and that's what I was chasing. And that meant whoever had $7, $2, $5, $4.50, you know, that's what I was after. I'm saying all of that to say I was sort of a petty addict. You know, I went after petty bits to get what I needed to get high. And that was sort of the scenario with the people that were on my A-step list. You know, it was petty offenses against people that really, really cared about me. You know, it was offenses against people that reached their hand out to me and said, Ed, I can see you hurting. Ed, you know, this ain't you. Ed, you know, I want to help you. You know, and those people that reached their hands out, you know, were the people that I took advantage of. So, you know, when I talk about that shame and guilt when I came around here, you know, that's what it was. You know, it was these people that were close to me. It wasn't nameless faces. It wasn't places that I broke into and I didn't know who it was. It wasn't given back, you know, to a store that I took whatever out of, you know, in the middle of the night, in the middle of the day. It was friends and families and loved ones that wanted to help me. And that brought about a lot of shame and guilt. You know, it was sort of just, you know, when I was using, I didn't recognize it, but those were the things that I was using to escape, those feelings, those emotions. I didn't want to think about, you know, the job that gave me my check on Thursday, because I wanted my check early, reminding me that, you know, Ed, you only work Thursday. So, you know, it was, you know, the family members. I didn't want to think about any of that, you know, so I got high. And if I thought about it, and I got high. And I thought about it, I got high. And I got high every chance I could get because I didn't want to think about it. And so here I am in Frederick, Maryland, sitting in a homeless shelter. Compared to D.C., a very nice homeless shelter. And I'm realizing that, you know, I have done so much to so many people that I cared about that I don't know how to deal with it. And, you know, that was sort of the beginning. You know, people told me, sit still. It'll be all right. You know, you can deal with that stuff later, but you have to start with not using. And so anyhow, when I thought about the 9th step, it took me to the 8th step, which took me to the 4th step, which took me to the 1st step, you know, which took me back to those very first days. I realize now that, you know, even in my first 6 months, year, 2 years, that shame and guilt still enwrapped me in some kind of way. You know, I didn't go back to D.C. I stayed in Frederick, probably the best thing I ever did. I didn't even go into the Beltway, you know, because that was, somebody pointed out, that was unsafe ground for me. And I ended up staying in Frederick and getting clean and, you know, listening to people share about steps. And I made it to my first year, and my brother died. And that was devastating for me. You know, my sponsor at that time had pointed out that if I had any reservations, I needed to approach that now. That was the reservation. And my brother died. And so I had to go back to D.C. I had to sort of deal with some of those stuff, some of that stuff. And what happened was one of my aunts, and I have 11 aunts, I stayed with the majority of them. The majority of them asked me to leave. I stole from the majority of them. And the majority of them were disappointed in me. And one of my aunts was going to pick me up and meet me and help me with the arrangements. And, you know, I think I may have worked the third step, and I saw this as an opportunity to do a ninth step. You know, I haven't did a fourth, third, fifth, sixth, seventh, or an eighth step, but I feel like this is an opportunity to do a ninth step. And I'm in the car with her, and I'm feeling good, you know, because this is a time that she can forgive me, and, you know, I can feel better, and I, you know, and all of this. And, you know, and I spilt my guts to her, and we're in the car, and it's her and me. And I finish, you know, waiting for her to tell me, you know, it's all right, I love you, it's good, it's, you know, you know, all of this stuff that I had in my mind of how it would went, it didn't. And, you know, she wasn't in that place. You know, she wasn't feeling it. It was fresh to her. You know, she was the last victim in D.C. that I took advantage of, the last family member. You know, she was very religious and, you know, and stole money from her, stole her car, smoked crack in her house. You know, she wasn't feeling it at all. And she just looked at me with a look, and, you know, I realized I made a mistake here. You know, I didn't have any instructions on how to go forward in a ninth step. I didn't have any information on how to proceed. I didn't have any information of it was okay if she wasn't happy with my amends. You know, my expectation was that I was going to receive something back from her that was going to quench my soul. You know, and it didn't happen. And that was like my first experience with the ninth step. And I realize now, you know, that sometimes making amends to people isn't the best thing to do if they're not in the right spot. You know, if that piece where it says, you know, if it caused harm to others, you know, I caused harm to her by just simply bringing this up. She was already hurting about my brother's death, but now I bring up all of the old wounds, threw salt in it, you know, and expected her to be okay with it. She wasn't. Anyhow, you know, that was my first experience. So after that, I decided to actually do some step work, and, you know, like 4 and 5 and 6, and, you know, some character defects, and, you know, and address those issues, and got to the 8th step. And you know, I heard in a meeting one time that, you know, you can put all of your 8th step list right on the back of a matchbook, I think they said, you know. And so I went with that. You know, that was simple and easy, you know. So I went with that. And, you know, and I put it all on the matchbook. It didn't fit, so I put it on the back of a business card. And you know, I realized, you know, I took some of it from the 4th step. I realized that a lot of the people that I had on my 9th step list were family and friends, you know, and it wasn't that monetary amends, you know. That would have been easy, you know. It would have been easy to take everybody in this room, and if I owed them and doll them out $20 as I go, you know, that would have been easy. That would have been a faceless amends, no feelings attached, you know. That would have been easy. These were people that were close to me that I had to actually address, you know, that I had to actually approach, that I had to actually, you know, let them have a say, and whatever they say was okay, you know, because they had anger, they had frustration. This, you know, this, the money part of the amends would have been easy, you know. The emotional part of the amends was a difficult thing, and, you know, and you know, it says in the first part of the 9th step something like, don't allow guilt or procrastination to stop you from making amends. I allowed procrastination to happen. I was on my 8th step after I did my little matchbook and my little post my little card. I was on my eighth step for 7 years. I did it. I wrote it out, but I wasn't willing to approach these people. You know, I just wasn't willing to do it, you know. I you know, that shame and guilt and all of that was still there. And I just, in the fear, you know, I found out in my sixth step that fear was a motivating factor in me not doing anything most of the time. I got to my ninth step and, you know, I had to address, you know, the family, the friends, and most of them were okay. You know, at this time, we're talking about it had been 14, 15 years. I had been clean that long. Most of them understood that I was in a better place. They would tell me, my family and friends called me by my middle name, which is Boris. And they would tell me, Boris, you know, it's okay. You know, you just keep doing what you're doing and stay up in Frederick and don't come back to D.C. It's okay. And you know, that was a relief. And I forgot to mention, you know, one of the things that my sponsor told me about my eighth step was to put me first on my eighth step. He told me that nobody could have done the things that I did to myself. Nobody. So, you know, all of the shame and guilt that I felt and the frustration about, you know, how I dealt with life and relationships and all of that, you know, I realized that, I had to address when it came to me. And the best way that I could address this, and everybody knows this part, you know, is not pick up. Simple. You know, not pick up and try to make a better me by working the steps. So there's a couple of people on the list that I have not been able to approach or make amends to because I didn't know where they were. You know, one's an ex-girlfriend, and the other one, probably the bigger of the two, probably the biggest on my list was her children. Me and her hooked up, got together. We started a nice little crack house, you know. We had the kids sitting and sleeping on the couch. We was feeding them nothing. You know, we were locking them out the house. You know, we were locking them out the bedroom when they had to go to the bathroom. We were telling them, go down to the neighbors to use the bathroom. You know, I felt something about that. I felt something about that more than I felt anything about anything that I did to anybody. You know, I felt like, you know, I had really harmed these kids. You know, it was a harm that I couldn't make up. There was an amends that I felt like I couldn't approach and make up and deal with. And somebody in my area with more time pointed out to me, you know, and this was like early on in the process, that you may never, ever, ever, ever see those kids again. You may never, ever, ever, ever be able to make amends to those kids. That may not be the case here. But, he said, I can take any kid and make an amends to them. Treat them special. Make sure that I'm a positive force in their life. Not do the same things. Try to make a change in their life. And that's sort of what I did. My brother that I told you about that died had had three kids, two nephews, two sons and a daughter. And in my active addiction, they weren't in, you know, the realm of things to do, not to play with, not to talk to, not to anything. And when he died, they were left fatherless, and they were left in, if anybody's from D.C., they were left in Bury Farms, you know. So if you got any idea, you know, pick the worst neighborhood that you know in your area, and you didn't pick Bury Farms, pretty much. And you know, so, you know, I took that advice from a dude. I became a part of their life. I didn't just become a part of their life. I became a fixture in their life, you know. I was there. I was somebody that they could call on. And at the beginning, you know, they didn't call me because they were like six and 8 or 9 or something, you know. But I, every weekend, I rode down from Frederick, Maryland to get them out of D.C., to bring them back to an environment that they could visualize as different, to see people that were different, to see a whole lifestyle that was different. And I did that for a good 13 years until my nephew decided he wanted to be more around the boys in the hood, which, you know, his decision. But my niece, you know, still came and spent time with me. And I bring them up because I'm sort of proudest of this amends that I was able to make to these kids. You know, I was able to be a part of their life, to show them something different, to help them to be somebody different. My niece, you know, I was able to help get into college. And she was the first person in our family that actually went to college. Unfortunately, she got herself out by getting pregnant, but that's okay, her choices. But she wrote me something one time, basically saying, you know, thank you for being a father figure in my life, for being somebody special, for being somebody that I can call and talk to. And she have a problem, she calls me. She calls me, she asks me, what can I do about this? What's the best thought? You know, she and you know, I was able to give back to her for the damages that I gave to that I did to that ex at the time's kids. And you know, right now this time, I brought them down to the convention to the beach. You know, I paid for 2 hotel rooms for them so that they can enjoy, again, something different than the environment that they grew up in, that they can see that there's a life outside of the life that they see. And, you know, and I really believe that this program isn't designed just for me. You know, it wasn't just, you know, our higher power, your higher power, my higher power, to help me to become a better person, to get a car, to get a house, you know, get some bling, you know, get whatever I think I want. But I think it was truly designed for me to be able to help other people, you know, for me to be able to take my hand for the blessings that I received and touch somebody else in their life to help them to receive a blessing. I have no idea how my niece and nephew might have turned out, but I know that they are not as bad if they would have turned out if I had left them alone. So, you know, my amends paid off, I feel like, you know. And it's a never-ending amends. It's something I got to continually do. And with a lot of the amends, you know, like I said, the emotional ones I was okay with, you know, I made and I did. And then some of them I wasn't able to do, like with my brother because he passed. And some of them, you know, like some of them, you know, society, amends to society. Sometimes I do simple things. You know, I hold the door open for somebody, even though they 5 step back. It don't do me no harm. They 5 step back. I can hold the door and, you know, and be somebody different. You know, I can think about other people as be so inclined to think about myself. You know, I don't know. You know, I hit on probably a third of the points that you can hit on by the 9th step. My point was just to tell you my story that, you know, you ain't got to be afraid of doing the 9th step. There is benefits for you. For me, there's been benefits. There's been a release from the shame and guilt that I came up here in, you know. I can hold my head up and I can deal with situations a lot better. I do have to say this. In the 16 years that I've been clean, I have added people to the list, including stealing, including ex-girlfriends, including, you know, bad behavior. You know, even though a 10th step should prevent that, you know, sometimes my character defects just roar up and I'm just me. You know, and that's okay too. You know, I can come back around from the eighth step and then hit the 9th again and make amends again. I try not to get that far past. I try to do a 10th. I apologize. I tried that, but, you know, this ain't a perfect program. I'm not a perfect person. You know, I do the best that I can. I guess that's all I got. Thank you guys for listening.
like to thank Ed for sharing. Next speaker. At this time, I'd like to thank, I'd like to welcome Ethan from Atlanta City. Position 9.
My name is Ephraim, and I'm an addict. And first and foremost, I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. And I would like to thank you and rooms like this for helping me get another day, another moment, another minute clean. You know, NA as such will never be organized, but we may create service boards and committees directly responsible to those they serve. And what this tradition means to me, or my experience with this tradition, it's a four-parted tradition. It talks about four different things. One, it talks about NA as such. It talks about we. It talks about service boards, and it talks about committees. Actually, it talks about five things, because it talks about what all of those elements are responsible to. The we that this tradition is talking about us, individual members that become part of groups. Everything in Narcotics Anonymous is directly or indirectly responsible to groups. And how that happens is that, and there's a purpose for why we have groups. And the group IP, it talks about a group being two addicts getting together for a specific purpose. And that purpose that the two addicts get together for is to facilitate or for a recovery meeting. A recovery meeting is NA as such, and it's completely separate from the group. Recovery meeting and NA as such are two separate entities. The recovery meeting is an entity. It only exists from the time it starts to the time it ends. The group continues to be. The group is us. It's the members. And the group is what everything in Narcotics Anonymous consists of, and everything, and the purpose of why we have recovery meetings. The most important service that we can do in Narcotics Anonymous is to have a meeting. Without meetings, we wouldn't have a purpose. Without meetings, there would be no us. Without meetings, there would be no reason to have groups, there would be no reason to have service boards, and there would be no reason to have committees. So, you know, in my experience and in my travels and in the process of getting clean and staying clean and being a part of and striving to give back what was so freely given to me over these years, I've come to understand, or at least my understanding of a lot of what we do here, it varies from place to place. And a lot of our literature sometimes can be confusing because I don't believe that it explains itself explicitly in terms of what we do and how we do it. As I mentioned, in the group IP, it talks about two addicts and describes two addicts as being a group. If you read the fourth tradition out of It Works, Why, and Why, it's probably the most explicit piece of literature we got that defines what a group is and what a meeting is. And it talks about a group can be responsible for more than one meeting. And it defines what type of meetings we have. It talks about closed meetings. It talks about open meetings. It talks about the different formats. You know, I've been in places where I hear people, matter of fact, just recently I heard someone come to me and they said, well, what is the policy of a group? Most groups that I've ever seen, have ever been affiliated with, the closest you can come to having policy is the format of the group. That is your policy. Now, some groups have written policy that as a member you can't do this, and as a member you can't do that, and as a member, in order to celebrate, you have to show up X amount of time. In order to participate in the group conscious process or the group business meeting, you have to make two meetings in order to vote, and all this other stuff, and all the restrictions or non-restrictions that we put on members to be part of. But in essence, all of our traditions complement one another. All 12 traditions complement. That's why it says it's a set of principles that are written so simply that we can follow them in our lives. It talks about the traditions being, you know, it talks about the steps and the traditions being a set of principles, and that they're written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. But also it talks about in the tradition, it says understanding of the tradition comes slowly over a period of time. And I can tell you, until we got some explicit literature like It Works How and Why, pretty much understanding tradition was left up to the interpretation of each individual member. Because if you read the traditions out of the basic text, it is just that. It's very basic. You get, in some traditions, you get two, three, four paragraphs, but none of it tells you exactly what the tradition, how it functions, and what its true meaning is, and how it interacts with members and groups of Narcotics Anonymous. So when you read It Works How and Why, for the first time in writing that literature, if you read the tradition out of It Works How and Why, all except for one tradition, it has principles. It tells you what the principles of that tradition is. And there's one principle that's almost in every tradition that we have, and it's the principle of integrity. And before It Works How and Why, we didn't talk about integrity in the principles of the traditions. And I believe that integrity is there for a reason, because it puts each individual member at a place where you have to define why you are doing what you're doing. Are you doing it for your own personal interest? Are you doing it for the betterment of the group? And is the group doing what they do for the betterment of the recovery meeting? Or is the group, when they design their format, are they designing it for what's fit to 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 members that consist of that group? Or are they designing it for the addict who walks through the door can better have a message and can have more of a productive atmosphere of recovery? And so those are some of the things that we talk about when we look at the autonomy of a group, and when we look at the dynamics and the makeups of groups and why groups do what they do. And when we go on to move from the group and we start to create service boards and committees, we ask ourselves, are we creating these elements of Narcotics Anonymous to further the primary purpose of the group? Are we doing it to benefit us as experienced members, or are we trying to develop something to further carry the message to the addict who's not here yet? Because the most important thing that we can do, and in our literature, it talks about a specific group of addicts that most of us forget, and that's the potential addict. You know, how do we reach out to the addicts that hasn't gotten here yet? How do we make what's possible or what was beneficiary to us, how do we make that available to them? And that's when we get to our service boards and committees. When we have committees like public information and H&I, which are crucial committees within any community of Narcotics Anonymous, that's not being serviced, then we're doing a disservice, not only to ourselves, but we're doing a disservice to the community that's not yet here. Yeah. You know, I'm a part of a home group that's in an inner city area in Atlantic City. And I go to different meetings all over the place. I'm afforded the opportunity, and I'm blessed to be able to see Narcotics Anonymous from all aspects and all areas. And I'm blessed and afforded to go different places, not just where people look like me, but where people look like all of us. Because I believe that Narcotics Anonymous truly consists of men and women and children and a variety of us that make what we do and make it work so perfectly. You know, and what I see happening is that in inner city communities, and I don't knock what anybody do. I've stopped criticizing and I start to strive to be a part of. Either you're going to be part of the solution or you're going to be part of the problem. If you're just sitting back giving it lip service, then you're part of the problem. If you're waiting in and you're saying this is what needs to be done and you're putting forth an effort to make it happen, then you're part of the solution. Right. And what I see happening in inner city communities is that there are no young people in recovery there. I go other places. I go to Ocean City. I go to Toms River. I go to all over New Jersey. And any place that I go to that's suburban or you know, rural or whatever, I see young people between the ages of 16 and 25. I go to Newark. You know, I go to New Brunswick. I go to Atlantic City. I go to Pleasantville. I go to other places in New Jersey. I go to Greater Philadelphia region, you know. I go to other places where that's considered inner city or whatever, and there are no young people. And I ask myself the question, why is this? What's happening in those communities What's happening in other communities where young people come into Narcotics Anonymous and they're afforded the opportunity to find recovery? Why isn't that happening in the communities that most of us are from? What are we not doing? And what I see happening is once again, is that we are doing some pretty cool things, but we're servicing ourselves. We're having speaker jams and conventions and so forth and so on, and our focus is strictly on those things. But there's very little emphasis on public information. There's very little emphasis on H&I and how can we take meetings into institutions, and how can we put posters in places, and how can we go into the school system and reach out to the potential addict. And see, this is not an inner city problem. This is a Narcotics Anonymous problem. Yeah. And we need everybody to get involved to make this work. Because the thing is that we have to hold our trusted servants and our groups accountable. That's right. And that if the groups that are in your community is not serving this in the community, if they're not creating service boards and committees to serve the community that they're in, then we need to step up to the plate and say, hey, guys, not talk about what they're not doing, but help them better do what they can, what they should be doing. And I think that sometimes we get so wrapped up in looking at what is that we don't look at what isn't. And how can we all become collectively involved in this thing? You know, because I believe that this is an issue that need to be talked about at conventions. This is an issue that need to be on the agenda at the World Convention. You know what I mean? We're talking about culture, diversity, and first tradition and all this other stuff. We need to be talking about, when we talk about, hey, who's missing from our meetings? We need to look around and truly look at who's missing from our meeting. Who's missing from your meeting? Like in Atlantic City, in the last 2 to 3 years, you know, a home group member, her son got clean years ago, and he was the youngest person in Atlantic City to get clean until this young lady came in a few months ago. So there are some things that we really need to be conscious of, and there's some things that we really need to be looking at. So when we talk about our service boards and committees, when we talk about looking at creating and designing our service boards and committees, we have to design them where they are servicing Narcotics Anonymous, where they're servicing our groups. And what I see happening is a lot of times we forget, when we start to talk about who these committees are directly responsible to, they are directly responsible to the groups, but they're indirectly responsible to the service bodies that they serve. So in reality, the only trusted servants that is directly responsible to the group is the GSR. Everybody else is responsible to that service body. The RSCM is responsible to area. So the RSCM is indirectly responsible to the group, but the RSCM is directly responsible to the GSRs. So if you have a GSR to go to an area and you're not directing your trusted servant, you're not giving them some direction in reference to how they should be serving, they just go there willy-nilly and do whatever they want to do. And if you're not having business meetings on a regular basis, you know, at least once a month, to decide what is best for the group and how can the group better serve the community, and when we send our GSR to area, that GSR should be directing and coming back from area telling you exactly not only what's going on in the area, but that GSR should be taking the issues of the group to area. So all the GSRs at area can have some idea of what's going on in the group. If a group is having problems with members coming from outside of or coming from institutions and the big thing in most groups now is signing papers. Everybody's going, they're losing their mind over whether or not they should sign papers or not. You know what I mean? They're misquoting tradition, talking about this an endorsement and it's a this and it's a that. You know, and our traditions tell us we're in cooperation with other organizations. We don't endorse them. We don't finance. We don't lend the name. But we do cooperate. Narcotics Anonymous is changing. The faces of Narcotics Anonymous is changing. How we provide services is changing. We got internet. We got social media. We got all kind of things that are happening now. You know what I mean? A lot of our tradition should be rewritten to include those things. And nobody's talking about it. You know, in our preambles it says, NA is a fellowship of men and women. It's no longer men and women. We got children coming in here. So why can't it be a fellowship of just people? You know, so we need to start looking at how do we change our language to include everybody? because the faces of Narcotics Anonymous is changing. What we do and how we do it is changing. We're growing in leaps and bounds. You know what I mean? Our old, you know, in our old literature, it says we have 58,000 meetings throughout the world meeting. But guess what? Now we got 100. We got over 100 and some meetings meeting regularly. We got 28,000 meetings meeting in the United States. Guess what? We got 18,000 meetings meeting in Iran. A week. We're talking weekly. That's the fastest growing fellowship in the world. And we're not even allowed to go there. That tells you something. So, you know, we need to look at what we're doing as not only as members. If you're a member of Narcotics Anonymous, if you say you're a member, the third tradition says you're a member when you say you are, but it goes on to say, however, membership is not automatic. Membership rests with the individual member. So you decide what degree of membership or how you want to design your membership in NA. You can be somebody to just come and make coffee and come once a week to your home group if you want. Or you can be someone to make 5 or 6 meetings and get involved in service and do some H&I and PI and get involved in conventions and walk all over the place and speak and become somebody in Narcotics Anonymous if that's what you choose to do. Or you can be somebody to wade in and just, you know what I mean? And really, everybody has a place in this piece. Everybody can do something. And nobody is no more important than the next person.
That's right.
Time don't make you important. You know what I mean? Service don't make you important. You know, you just are important. You know, sometimes I say to myself, you know, like I talk and I talk to members and I love my network of people, both men and women. See, I don't discriminate. I don't believe I can just get something from men. I believe I get something from everybody. I believe that even when you set out to do something harmful to me, you teach me a lesson. Because I've learned, service have taught me so much about myself. See, I heard someone said to me, I'm hiding out in service. How the hell can you hide out in service? That can be the most harmful place you can be sometimes, in service. You know, so today I find, man, that being a part of this fellowship and being a member of Narcotics Anonymous, And being involved in what we do have taught me, have shown me. I belong to a home group where 10 years ago we fought about everything. Today we fight about nothing. We actually practice what they're trying to do, what they're trying to implement in Narcotics Anonymous called consensus-based decision making. We practice that in our home group. We don't vote. We don't raise our hands. We put all the issues on the table and we ask, do everybody understand this? And everybody said, yes. Yeah, so do anybody have a problem with this? Say no. And that's us. That's what we do. And if you know Frontline Recovery Group and Narcotics Anonymous that meet from 7 to 8:30 on Wednesdays in Atlantic City, you know that's a far cry from what we used to be. We fought about everything. And that has given me hope because I believe that if we can come from where we used to be to where we are today, then I believe that narcotics as a whole can come from any place in the world. I believe that what we do is so precious here that it actually saved lives. You know, I don't have to ask anybody about these things. I've seen it happen in my life. I've seen it happen in the people's lives around us. I've seen the ninth tradition work at its highest. I've seen addicts who hate one another get together to carry a message, to do service, to take a meeting into an institution. You know, I've seen groups and areas come together and do some phenomenal things. In the spirit of unity. You know, it's amazing that what's going on in Narcotics Anonymous today. Our whole service structure and system is changing. And I believe that when we get to a place where we get real comfortable, we need something to shake us up. I have never seen as many people talk about world service and area service and regional service as I've seen in the last 3 years. I mean, people are angry about shit and they don't even know why they're angry. You know, they talk about a service system proposal, they don't even know what it is. You know, we're talking about changing things. We don't even know what we're changing. But the blessing is that if you're a member of Narcotics Anonymous, if you're truly a part of this process, give yourself a break and get involved. Get in. Dive in. Learn what we do here. Learn about the traditions. They're not hard. They're a very, very simple piece of literature that we have that's not hard to figure out. It applies to everything we do. The same principles that are in the steps, the same principles that are in the traditions, are the same. They're universal principles. Integrity is integrity no matter how you slice it. Honesty is honesty no matter how you slice it. See, I've found that for most of us, we get involved, and like I know for me, when I got involved in service, like really early on, it was like an ego booster. I just wanted to be part of something. I just wanted to belong to something. I just wanted to give back what was so freely given to me. See, I got here through a hotline. I called a guy on a Friday night, Saturday morning, and I told him that I wanted to die and I didn't know how to stop using. And he answered the phone. And it was an addict on the other end of a phone called a hotline that we used to have in our area. And this guy talked to me for an hour and a half, twice. He talked to me for 3 hours. He didn't know me from a can of paint. He had no clue who I was. He didn't know the color of my skin. He knew nothing about me. He just knew that I was an addict and I need help. And the fire was lit from that point. When I walked into a meeting, and I walked into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and I seen addicts, I felt like I was home. And when I got a year clean, I said, I'm going to be that hotline cheer. I want to be on the other end of that phone so I can provide the same service that was provided to me. And I became the hotline cheer. And we lit the fire on the other group members, and they became the hotline cheer. And our one group, we probably had 3-4 hotline members. I think that hotline served was the last, the members in our home group was the last members to serve on the hotline. Before, you know, it just dissolved and we got involved, you know, it became a regional helpline. But it's just a blessing, man, that if you're a member of a home group, you know, our group, man, and I tell you, and I keep talking about our group because it's not mine. See, that's one thing I really strive not to do is take ownership of anything. I believe that the we of this program is what rendered the disease of addiction powerless. Yeah. I know without the we, I know I don't stand a chance. I know that you don't stand a chance. So I don't play games with myself. You know what I mean? I know I can be arrogant, condescending, self-righteous on any given day. It don't take much for me to get there. But I know that the we is what knocks all that nonsense out of what's going on with me, and it keeps me humble. See, because just when I think I got this program, something happens to show me that I really don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I really don't know what I'm doing. That I'm only this close. You know what I mean? And I still need help. And that's why today, man, I just believe that we have so much work to do. We have so much work to do. We have so many places that are so untouched in terms of what we're doing. And I tell you something, man, that I'm going to continue to come. I'm going to continue to be a part of. And I'm going to continue to voice what I believe, what I see happening in our midst that need to be looked at. Because I believe that somebody needs, you know, I believe that each of us have a voice. Each of us need to stand up for what we believe in. I don't believe that we fall for anything. I believe that we care enough to love one another enough that we want the very message that was given to us to be available to the next person coming through the door, whether they're 16 or 25 or 35 or 55 or 65, that message should be available for them to get no matter what community they come from. And so today, you know, we have a lot of work to do. You know, our service boards committees need a lot of help. So if you're out there and you're criticizing what they're doing or not doing, get involved. You know, lend a hand. We need every voice. We need everybody. Everybody have a place. So find your niche, jump in with both feet, and enjoy the ride. Thanks for letting me share.
My name is Herb Maddie.
I heard.
From my house.